Story of Irish Whiskey is a five-part series about how three Irish families saved it from extinction. The following is a bonus episode from the launch of the series with producer Dara Whelan, Irish distillers archivist Carol Quinn, and master distiller Brian Nation discussing the making of the podcast and some of the standout moments from the episodes.
The first episode, Brian, it opens up 1966, the Turin House meeting, the coming together of the Irish whiskey families down in County Waterford. Talk to me about the significance of those families coming together and what it meant.
In 1966, Irish whiskey was in massive decline. It was almost dead at that stage, and you had the three powerhouses left. You had Powers, you had Jemison, and you had Cork Distilleries. And they would have all been proud families. They would have been strong individuals, and they would have been proud of the brands that they had. So the decision that they had at that stage was to keep going themselves and trying to grow their own brands on the market. But that most likely would have actually caused them to, if they were competing against each other, for their brands to actually go down as well. And it could have stayed the death nail for Irish whiskey. So instead, what they did is they made a very brave decision and a very important decision for Irish whiskey insofar as that they came together and actually amalgamated to form Irish Distillers. Now, if you can put yourself back in their shoes at that time, that definitely was not an easy decision. As you can imagine, the characters of that time, as you can imagine the people of that time, and really proud of the brands that they had grown and the heritage that they had grown, to actually agree to amalgamate must have been difficult, but was the best decision. Because if the decision wasn't made, we certainly wouldn't be sitting here today, I feel, talking about Irish whiskey.
We'll get to the future in a few minutes. I'm fascinated. There was Dublin and Cork rivalries. Surprise, surprise. Carol, talk to me about maybe the Mr. Norbert Murphy from Cork.
Yes, I sit here with a proud Cork accent talking about rivalry with Dublin. There was rivalry. There was suspicion. There was a keen eye kept on both sides. As archivist for Irish Distillers, I have the records of the three different companies. And in the minute books of Jemison, every season it opens with the price of whiskey in Cork. And if you look at the Cork minute books, every season they open with the price that Jemison has been sold in Dublin. So there's a beady eye being cast both ways. So there was what I'd call a healthy rivalry, but there was a great respect. There was a tremendous respect between the different distilleries and the families of distillers. And they were used to working in tandem together. They had often come together when the industry was under threat. For example, in 1916, when the government threatened to close all the distilleries and turn them into munition factories to support the war effort in the First World War, they banded together to form the Irish Pot Still Distillers Association, with Andrew Jemison as the chairman and Sir Thomas Talbot Power as the vice chairman and Mr. Norbert Murphy as a member of the board. And that was the first time I came across that name, and it's a bit of a distinctive name. Anybody know anyone called Norbert? No. It's actually a name I'm trying to bring back, but it's a single-handed effort by me. He is a colossus, an absolute colossus of the Irish whiskey world, but he's virtually unknown. And that's one of the ambitions I think I had for these podcasts, was to shine a light on these people who had done so much for the industry. He became manager of the North Mall Distillery about 1910. And after Irish Distillers was formed in 1966, he was the first president, and he died in the 1970s. He had 70 years at the helm of Irish whiskey. He saw it through the First World War. He oversaw it through Prohibition, the Second World War, economic trade wars. I see, you know, we're now consumed with similar things. There's Brexit on the horizon. You know, there's maybe trouble with America on the horizon. This man saw it all and survived. And he survived due to being consumer-centric and having a nimbleness of mind. And that's something that I'm
And also about. Tight with
well,
money.
No.
But because of what he lived through, in fairness.
Well, you know, this is it. If you've come through rationing. But Mr. Norbert, as he grew older, he had certain quirks of personality. And he liked to come to Middleton Distillery on the same day every week doing a surprise inspection. So head office at that time was in Cork City Centre, and the telephone would ring, Mr. Norbert on way for surprise inspection. And he had two things that he absolutely hated to see. He hated to see men standing around the distillery yard, because that meant you had too many and they weren't employed. And he hated to see electric lights on. So there was one guy, and he would go in front of the surprise inspection, turning off all the electric lights. Mr. Norbert would pass through. Somebody else behind him turning them back on so people could see what they were doing. But, you know, this was done with huge affection for him because he had done so much for the industry.
We'll leave Cork there for a second, yeah. If you don't mind. I want to take it back to the 1800s because the series starts with the Turin House meeting, but then we flash back in terms of the past. So we take it from where it's on its knees, you know, 1966, but let's not forget Irish whiskey was on the world stage in the 1800s.
Absolutely.
Just give us a snapshot of just how much it was on the global stage at that time.
In the period 1880s, 1890s, if you were a connoisseur of fine drinks, fine wines, champagnes, cognacs, you drank Irish whiskey. It was the drink of the connoisseur. It was expensive, but it was something that you were, I was going to say, happy to pay more for. It was something that you expected to pay more for because it was a prestige and premium drink. And until I started going through the records, I had no idea of the worldwide reach of this drink. Our records show it was being sold all over South America in the 1880s. It was being sold in Egypt, in Cairo. Connor made reference there to Nigeria. If we were selling in half the markets that it had been selling in the 1880s, we would be so thrilled today. And it was being sold as a premium drink. And that's something that I really hope comes across in the podcast, is the pride there was in this Irish product that was being sold all over the world and being held in such high esteem. And there weren't too many other products out of Ireland at the time that were held in such high value. And that's something that I hope is going to reignite, you know, a proper sense of pride in a wonderful product that is again reaching out to the world. And one example just to share with you is that by 1909, Jameson was selling so much whiskey in Honolulu that they had a specific label printed for Honolulu, if you can imagine that.
And there was also, 1893, the Chicago World Fair, where Powers had built a 30-foot-high replica of a round tower with Powers whiskey bottles.
That was something that absolutely blew me away when I first saw it. I knew what the World's Fairs were. There were these huge gatherings that would happen every 2 to 3 years, and they'd be held in a different country. And they really were, what they said, a world fair. People would travel all over from the globe to the host country. And in 1893, it was being hosted in Chicago. The previous World's Fair had been hosted in Paris, and the centerpiece there was the Eiffel Tower. So the Americans had to come up with something, a showstopper, literally. And what they came up with was the Ferris wheel. That was the first time a Ferris wheel was ever unveiled. And at these World's Fair, you'd find cutting-edge technology, the latest innovations, the newest products. They were very, very forward-facing, kind of modern affairs. And you went there to impress people. You weren't going there to put, you know, up at the table and hope somebody come by and sample your wares. You were there to make a statement. And Powers made the most incredible statement. Their exhibition at the 1893 World's Fair was a life-size replica of the O'Connell Monument in Glasnevin, an Irish round tower. What could be a stronger statement of pride and nationality than that? And it was 30 feet high, and it had mahogany tiers on which stood bottles of Powers Gold label. Now, the labels at that time, they were made from ground bronze. They were very metallic. And behind each bottle was a silver mirror. So you would have walked into this hall and you would have just looked up and up and your jaw would have dropped. And shining out from the electric lights would be shards of gold from the label, shards of silver from the mirror. And you would say, "What is this?" And they would say, "This is Irish whiskey."
Incredible. Yeah. Suffice to say, I interviewed Carol about a dozen times for this podcast. I hope the passion comes through, that you get it on stage, and I hope you do get that sense of the passion when you listen to the podcast as well, because amazing stories like that. I studied history in college. I didn't know these stories about Irish whiskey, and they haven't, you know, they might introduce an Irish whiskey module into the history program.
That's an idea.
So, you know, there you go. That'll be the next one. I'm going to come to you in a second, Brian, but just quickly on that, we talk about innovation and ingenuity. And forward thinking, you know, from, we think of it in a modern context.
Yeah.
But
But and Conor referenced the John Jameson II, the notebook, the cover, but the mash bills.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that story and how then that links into your work, Brian. But the grains, you found it, and the grains actually fell. Tell me about that.
Well, that's the incredible legacy that Irish distillers have. We have 200 years of distilling experience, and that experience has been passed on through the generations, ending up with my colleague here.
No pressure.
No pressure at all. But as I go through the archives, some records stand out. And this was a small notebook. It's about the size of my hand. And it was the pocket notebook of John Jameson II as a hands-on distiller in 1826 in Bow Street, in which he is writing in the mash bills for Jameson whiskey. And at the time, the Bow Street distillery was exactly the size of our micro distillery in Dublin. And if, sorry, in Dublin, in Middleton. Here I am in Dublin thinking everything's in Dublin. Our micro distillery in Middleton was exactly the size of Bow Street in 1826. So we have those recipes, and it would be very easy for Brian to maybe replicate those, but that's not what we want to do. You know, we want to use the past as a springboard towards the future. But I think what you were mentioning there, as I was going through the record, it was falling apart. So I sent it down to a paper conservator in Muckra's house in Killarney, and he took the binding apart and put it back together. And as he took it apart, out fell grains of barley. The actual barley that in 1826 was making Jameson whiskey. And to be able to physically touch your history like that is something incredibly special.
And how does that then link in for you, Brian? Because that must be incredible in terms of looking back at this body of work and how they were, you know, seeing it back then. And how did that influence,
well,
you know, your...
I mean, when we come back to even when we're talking about 1966, about the amalgamation, what was great there is that all of the different distillate styles and the expressions were brought forward into Irish distillers. So that the traditions of all of the three distilleries were actually kept going and kept alive. And single pot still whiskey, obviously being the quintessential way Irish whiskey has been made in years gone by, that mash bill has been so important to our success and the success of the Irish whiskey category. So using that unmalted barley and malted barley and giving that creamy mouthfeel, that is the tradition, that is the heritage of pot still Irish whiskey. When it comes to something like the John Jameson II notebook, what it actually did for us as well is it almost gave full credence to us using and trialing different cereal types in our micro distillery, like oats and like rye. But we didn't just take those mash bills and just completely copy them. What we did was we actually took them further. We tried a little bit more. We tried a little bit more oats. We tried a little bit more rye. We didn't always get it right, but, you know, we have actually developed some fantastic distillates. And it really is carrying on the tradition of innovation from all of those distilleries, the Powers, the Jameson, the Cork distilleries, that really made them successful and made them stand the test of time. And that is what's allowing Irish distillers to continue to progress, to continue to grow, and to actually develop the range of whiskies that you see today. And I suppose it was instrumental as well in giving us the... I suppose having that tradition of innovation, giving us the license to develop a new brand like Method and Madness, where a lot of our innovative whiskies are really being showcased for the first time as well, that wouldn't have the innovations that wouldn't have sat in the Jameson, the Powers, or the Redbreast, or the Middleton family. This is now a springboard to show other innovations that we're doing. So it's a really exciting time. We wreck Carol's head every now and then because we go into the archives saying, "Carol, have you found anything else? Come on, give us a go, give us a look." And sometimes she's nice to us. Sometimes she tells us get out because she's into something. She's doing something else. But you know, it is great to have 250 years of history, of heritage, of stories to be able to walk next door from the micro distillery or from the main plant and say, "Carol, show us, give us a look." And that really does. I suppose it creates a massive passion for everybody at Middleton and everybody in Irish distillers to keep innovating and to keep growing.
What strikes me of that as well is it's easy to forget then, isn't it, how much it was on its knees, how close it was to extinction. Yeah. As a cultural legacy, if anything, you know, as well as the economic side of it. Maybe give us a snapshot of the kind of 1900s, the external factors, the prohibition.
Yeah, I really don't think people realise how close this category came to absolute extinction. you know, not just not selling well, but absolute extinction. And to kind of put that into focus, during the 1950s, the late 1950s, Middleton Distillery was distilling for 3 weeks a year. That's it, because there was no point distilling any further because there was no market for its product. We were talking about this with Ger Buckley on the train on the way up, and he made the point that it had the largest pot still in the world, and yet was only distilling for 3 weeks a year. And it had been brought to its knees by a series of external circumstances. It was nothing to do with the distilleries or the quality of the product. And it begins with the First World War, around the period 1914, 1915. Ireland is an island nation, and as soon as war was declared, there was submarine activity, so there was an embargo on shipping. And if you're export-led, as Irish whiskey was, this was problematic. But, you know, being the forward-thinking people they were, they put their heads down. And by 1919, Jameson records that it had its best distilling period ever, which was misfortunate, because that's the year that Prohibition hits in America. And what Prohibition did for Irish whiskey is it tarnished the reputation. Rather than losing a market, they might have lost America, but they had Australia, they had New Zealand, they had India, they had Canada. But in America, as soon as you have the moonshiner setting up, they call their rotgut Irish whiskey because people are used to paying more for it. And for a generation, their first taste of what they believe to be Irish whiskey is this horrible, burning, fiery liquid. And that's when you begin to hear, oh, I don't like whiskey, it burns, which was never the signature style or taste of Irish whiskey. So what you have then following on is the 1930s. And we hit an economic trade war with Britain. Now, this is an absolute calamity, because overnight, you lose any territory associated with the British Empire. You lose India, you lose Canada, you lose Australia, you lose New Zealand. They're reeling from this. And this is when you begin to see distilleries toppling all over Ireland, one after the other closing down. And what happens at the end of the 1930s? You go straight into the Second World War. And again, another embargo on exports. By the 1950s, they've had 4 decades of not being able to sell to their customer. And the customer forgot them. That's basically what happened. And they no longer had the financial clout to relaunch themselves on the world stage. The market for Irish whiskey had shrunk to the island of Ireland, till you get to the point in the early 1960s that in the Republic, you've only got three distilleries left. Jameson, Powers, and the Cork Distilleries Company eking out a survival. And they were faced with colossal calamity, total extinction, unless they did something radical. And that radical thing was to come together, to put aside 200 years of rivalry and form one new company and pool their resources and cooperate together. And that spirit of pooling and of cooperation has what has inspired every action of Irish distillers ever since.
And it was coming together, obviously sacrificing the individual for the greater good.
Yeah.
But it still, Brian, took, you know, 22 years really before the Pernod Ricard takeover that Irish whiskey was able to put itself back out onto the global stage, would you say?
Absolutely. And when you think of even in the 80s, when even at that stage, the sales of Irish whiskey still wouldn't have been big, the easy option at that stage would have been to shut the distillery for half a year. But the likes of Barry Crockett, Brendan Monks, Barry Walsh, who's no longer with us, basically they had the foresight to lay down stocks of different styles of single pot still whiskey in different cask types. And that innovation was there that allowed us to really drive the rebirth of single pot still Irish whiskey in the years to come. Coming back to your point about the Pernod Ricard coming in, if you think of it, Irish distillers were becoming strong, but still they didn't have that global reach. They also didn't have the capital for investment to actually grow the distillery. So having somebody like Pernod Ricard coming in was a massive, massive addition and giving that global reach so that we could get our brands to the markets again, particularly Jameson at the time. And then obviously to get the investment to grow the distillery to what it effectively is today. And those couple of things that happened over that time really have been what has led to the renaissance of Irish whiskey and the reason that we're seeing so many distilleries now coming on stream, all looking to make single pots of Irish whiskey. But it has to be remembered that Irish distillers were the guardians of that and still are the guardians of single pots of Irish whiskey.
And I think it's the quality, isn't it? It's the emphasis on the quality all the time, not and going back to the kind of the bootleggers and that, you know, how quickly a name you can lose, you know, the reputation from
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Let's just finish up maybe then just talking about the Renaissance. It is incredible, isn't it? 21st century, how, you know, you see the 24, 25 distilleries around the country. I think it was Charles O'Reilly from the Parkers talked about at the end of the podcast, and we'll hear a couple of stories from yourselves, is the pride I think the families would have had seeing how the industry as a whole was lifted. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the success of Jameson worldwide over the last number of years has really driven the success of and driven to the growth of the single of Irish whiskey category, and particularly driven by single pots of Irish whiskey as well, and the love of that. It's great to see the category growing now, and you're seeing so many distilleries coming on stream. What is actually very good as well is to see a lot of them coming under the Irish Whiskey Association as well. And, you know, there's a mentoring program, which you wouldn't see anywhere else in the world, to see that through this Irish Whiskey Association, different distilleries are working together, helping other new entrants if they want that help, all for the greater good of the category, all to ensure that the quality of Irish whiskey stays as good as it is now and actually continues to grow. So it's a really exciting time. Conor said earlier on, we're now with about 24 distilleries at this stage, with another 20 plus in different stages of planning or construction. Who would have thought that back in 1980 that this was going to happen? And it's amazing to meet so many of the new entrants as well, and to see the passion that they have for the brands that they want to bring on stream and the products that they want to grow. Yeah. It really is heartening to see.
And just on that, can I go to, we have Frank Egan and David O'Reilly from Paris family here. David, what age were you in 1966, Turin House meeting? You don't remember?
Well, actually, I got quite upset. I nearly walked out. Dara comes up to me and he says, "Now, what did you think of the agreement in 1966? And I went, "I was five." So I don't actually have a memory, age five, of the agreement, but I do have a memory of my father, who was Reggie O'Reilly, who sadly died in 89, age 59, and he was passionate about selling Jameson whiskey around the world, and he used to travel perhaps 6 months a year selling Jameson whiskey, and in fact, he'd be so proud today to see, you know, whatever he did around the world, and there was lots of eating and drinking that went with it, he would be so proud to see that Jameson is right there at the top. And I would imagine he'd turn in his grave to actually see the sales numbers, the 7.5 million.
Tell me that, from the Paris family, and there was no problem in terms of, you know, we talked about this earlier, the way the families came together, that in the 1970s, your father was selling the Jameson brand, and it just goes to show you how they all kind of just mucked in and rode together then, really.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting, because Dara said, and he did put me on the spot, as Frank and I walked in, you know, we might zone in on you in half an hour's time. I went, whoa. And but what is interesting, and obviously I've been thinking about it over the last half an hour, you know, I was at school with some of the Jameson sons. So little did I even probably know the link at that stage, but, you know, it was just the way it was.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking of the way it was, also joined by Ger Buckley, fifth generation Cooper. Ger.
That's correct.
Still going strong.
When's
retirement?
Well, hopefully it won't be for a long time yet. Yeah, I lived through a bad period of Irish whiskey in the 70s and 80s when we were still on our knees. We still weren't doing that well. And in fairness, it was really when Pernod Ricard came in as well. Now, a lot of the stock, as Brian said, had been laid down. And that, under Pernod Ricard, gave us an enormous reach. I remember a statement at the time that we hadn't won ambassador or whatever in Italy, and overnight we had something like 400. So that, and that's growth through Pernod Ricard. In the imaginary conversations I'd have with my dad about the way the business is now, the way Coopering is, the way, he would be over the moon to see it now, to see it so prosper. And he used to always say to me, even when I was a kid, before I started working, you know, you must always try and do everything you can for the company. As long as the company succeeds, we all succeed. We all earn a living. And I wasn't the only one that was a fifth-generation cooper. I mean, everybody in the distillery were generations. I still work with people who are three and four generations in the distillery. It was such a, always a great employer, great service, great conditions, great company to work for, and you tend to have a job for life, as I do at this stage. So I'm coming up to 44 years now at this stage. So it has been a job for life. And I still get an enormous kick to see the success of Jameson and Irish whiskey. And as Brian was saying, with all the new distilleries coming on board, a lot of the company policy is to give every assistance we can. Like last summer, I went to Clonakilty Distillery and spent a day training somebody on how to fix leaks, how to handle barrels, all that kind of stuff. I'm due to go to some other distilleries in the summer coming. So we are as much passionate about keeping the category the way it is and keeping the standard of Irish whiskey, especially pot still, as high as it has been over generations. And one of my earliest memories, we were talking about this earlier, was I was always maybe 6 or 7, and we only lived a couple of hundred yards from the distillery in the city in Watercourse Road. And you could go in that time as a boy, you know, there was no issues with security or health and safety or any of that kind of stuff. And to walk into the cooperage and to see all the other coopers working, and the aromas and the smell that you would get of whiskey and oak and all those, they were amazing smells and experiences to me that I kind of feel guilty still that when I still smell a whiskey, it just reminds me of my youth. Not that I was drinking at 6 or 7, but that I was having this amazing experience of wonder to actually spend a lifetime working in that industry and working with wood and working in the whiskey business. You know, I wouldn't change a thing, and I'm so lucky to have done that, you know.
And that's why I wanted to talk to you, and is because despite all the technology, despite everything that's happening in terms of modern developments, so much of it still comes down to the artisanal approach. And we spoke about this in the podcast, Brian. It's the smell of something, the touch of something. It's there's still that human element that is still so important to the making of this product.
And like what we do is as much as technology has improved and computers and everything else, we still very much are hands-on, still doing it exactly the same as John Jameson would have done, and the Power families and the Murphy families in Cork, in that we must make a quality distillate, which is Brian's job. We must put it into a barrel to leave the wood do its work for years on end. And we still do exactly the same thing. We might do it more efficiently and better. I think we make better whiskies now than we've ever made in the past. But essentially, we're still doing that same knowledge and tradition built up over 250 years. And as we were saying, my family have been doing this for 200 years. So that's what's magic about it. And magic to think that we were the ones in this country who invented whiskey and bringing it back to the world. So
it's incredible. It's an incredible time. I was thrilled to be able to work on this as a podcast. And I just, before I let you go, I do hope and I'd recommend for if everybody tonight can get out your phones, get out the Apple Podcasts or Spotify app, whatever you have, subscribe, rate it, have a listen to it. Let us know what you think of it. It would be just great to get your feedback. And who knows, there might be a season 2. You never know. I want to thank Carol Quinn, Archivist Irish Distillers, and Brian Nation, Master Distiller, for joining us today. Thank you.
You've been listening to a special episode from the launch of the podcast series A Story of Irish Whiskey with producer Dara Whelan, Irish Distillers Archivist Carol Quinn, and Master Distiller Brian Nation. Make sure to listen and subscribe to the rest of the series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.